I knew very early on, like working for someone was like very not in the cards for me. Welcome to Failure with Ryan Kavanaugh. And actually today, it's Failure with Ryan Kavanaugh, but actually it's Failure with Chris Johnson, because Chris is going to be grilling me. I think as everybody knows at this point, Failure is a show, as we say, where we are failure's father, because success has many fathers and failure has none. And here we found a father. And the concept, very basically, of our show is there is not a successful person I know who has not experienced more failure than success. It's that simple. And the success in general are the things that happen in between failures. And generally failures are this big and the successes are this big. And no one knows that better than Chris, who trains the best of the best, who in the best of success, I think hit 30%, which he'll probably get into. But as I'm usually talking to other people about their failures in between success, trying to help people understand that this perfect little Instagram world where everything looks immediate and, you know, oh my God, that guy just did one thing and got a Ferrari and had a house and a mansion and got married. No, it doesn't work like that. We fail, we fail, we fall, we get back up. And, we're the men in the arena, which is my favorite quote. So today,
yeah,
I'm going to open up.
Yeah.
And I'm very blessed and lucky to have Chris here as a friend, someone who I really look up to, admire, and who the best of the best in not just MBA, but top companies look to succeed. So here I am.
Here we go. And you know, Ryan, when we look at failure, a lot of people probably only see your success, right? And you know, they only see, you know, maybe financial gains, but really you have a good story. And, you know, we want to kind of dive into not only your story, but some things that people would never even know about you, right? I think that's going to be fun because it allows you to be vulnerable. And being vulnerable is the first step to accepting your failure.
It's very true. Very true. But I thought I got rid of those pictures.
Well, social media wasn't around as we grew up. So a lot of times social media are able to capture the story for people now and kind of keep track of it. So a lot of data and a lot of things get lost because I know personally for you, you don't celebrate a lot, right? Because you're always getting ready for the next game. That's what I say to athletes. So like a person that don't celebrate a lot and look at what they've done, they're always moving forward. And so I want to dive in and I kind of want to start with like your background with your parents and like your dad was extremely successful. But a lot of times people and they don't look at when you have a successful father, where he came from and then how he expects for you to go through something to go beyond him. So like kind of tell us a little bit about like your father, your parent,
sure,
like your parents and where they came from before you got to beautiful LA.
So it's everything is so poignant, of course, but it really drives to the root of who I am. So my grandparents, my dad's parents were Holocaust survivors. So they were born in Poland, in Krakow, little town in Poland. And my grandmother had six brothers and sisters, and my grandfather had seven brothers and sisters. And World War II broke out, and all but one of my grandmother's brothers and sisters were killed, her mother and father, and my grandfather's entire family was wiped out. So they both went into camps at 14, and they were in camps until they were 19. So, you know, they were, I mean, not to be graphic, you know, beaten, raped, tortured, worked.
Yeah.
When they came out, my grandmother was 19, she weighed 78 pounds, couldn't walk. But they put them into these camps after they came out. I'm not talking about concentration camps, but camps was the wrong word, but they were relocation centers because they didn't have family, they didn't have anywhere to go. So Germany put them there for about 2 years. And usually, basically, people got married very fast because they were trying to rebuild family.
Right.
So my grandmother and grandfather met, had my dad. I think he was about two, and they came here to the U.S. They had $10 to their name. They didn't have passed a sixth grade education and spoke no English. So that's when I think of like where I come from, you know, that's where I come from. And that's why it's interesting in failure no matter how bad it is, I always think, I didn't go through that.
Right.
So my family, it's in my genes, like they went through that. I can get through anything. There's nothing that I can't get through. So it starts there, and it goes to, you know, my dad actually, so I'll tell you this crazy story that I've actually not told many people. It gives me chills, and this is why I know, like, life is kind of has these interesting meant-to-be moments.
Right.
So my dad had polio when he was sick. And back then, polio was it was a death sentence. And he had the intubator in, and he was in the bubble, and he was there for 6 weeks. And my grandmother and grandfather, I guess they had been in the hospital for a week at the time.
Right.
Actually, I got to back up a little bit on this one because it's a crazy story. So when my grandmother was on the death march, I don't know if you know what the death march is, but
I've heard of it.
It was,
yeah. Tell us a little bit.
When they were going from one camp to another,
okay.
The SS would round people up. They were basically had very limited clothes. It was in the snow, and they'd march them to get them from one place to another. You know, sometimes hundreds of miles. They'd sleep in like a barn. They'd get a piece of bread or a leaf, and people would often die just from
right
the death
away,
march
because
they're malnourished, they're cold. So there was one woman in the camp and on this march that was from my grandmother's hometown, the only person she knew. And as they were marching, she saw the woman was sick. If they saw you were sick, they killed you immediately. So my grandmother was kind of propping her up the whole time and trying to not let them see her. And they stopped in a barn to sleep. And my grandmother, they got a piece of bread and some water that was there, like soup, heated water. So my grandmother actually took her bread, gave it to the lady, and went and basically stole more bread, which if she got caught, she'd be killed.
Right.
And the lady had really bad fever, and she put her in her lap, and she was, you know, telling her everything's going to be okay. And the lady's like, one day, you risked your life for me, I'm going to repay you. And this girl died that night in her lap. And so cut forward, and that's a sad story to start with. My dad had polio, and doctors more or less had said he wasn't going to make it. And my grandmother had been in the hospital for a week and a half. He is in the bubble. He had the thing in, and the doctors are like, listen, you got to go home and shower, and you know, you can't just, nothing's going to happen
right,
in a day.
Right.
So she goes home, showers, gets sleep, and she has a dream. And the woman in a gown that from the death march that she hadn't really thought about comes back to her and is floating in front of her house and says, I promised you one day I'd repay you. Your son's going to be fine. So the way they told the story is they got up. She told my grandfather what happened. They walked outside. This is in LA. And there was snow on the ground. So this is how they tell it, obviously.
Wow.
But they were rushing to the hospital. And so they kind of were like, that's weird. But okay. They get to the hospital. They walk into his room. And he's not in the intubator. So she thinks he's passed away. So she starts losing, crying, screaming, where's my son? Where's my son? And the doctor comes in and says, Miss Konitz. So my dad changed his name. It used to be Konitz. Miss Konitz, calm down, calm down, calm down. And she's screaming and she's like, where's my son? They're like, we don't know what happened, but he pulled his own tube out last night and he's okay. Like, so that to me goes to the very beginning of where I was born and what I'm from, which is, I believe it very karmically in a greater power.
Yeah. I mean, you have a family angel.
I do.
Yeah,
I have a lot of them. I feel like I have family angels all around me.
So did your dad, how long did he live? And I can see where like that inspiration came from, because like, you know, when you look at you, Ryan, being from Brentwood, you know, people wouldn't expect that background to start with, right? And everyone's background is different, and this is super unique and super interesting. And you can see, like, I wonder how your dad, like, fathered him. He made him, like, you know, we can't go back to that.
So it's interesting because my dad was working in a shoe store by the time he was 10. And when he talks about his childhood, you know, he talks about how, because they had cousins and, you know, they lived, I want to say like 8 of them in an apartment or 9 of them in an apartment. And he talks about he had one toy. He remembers his childhood as being the happiest, most loving childhood ever. He doesn't think about, he didn't have toys. He doesn't think about, they didn't have things, you know. And what he remembers that he, other kids played after school activities and he had to go work in a shoe store. And my grandmother was a seamstress at night and I forgot something during the day. And my grandfather sold shoes during the day. but instilled a work ethic. And what's very interesting is you know, he was very bright, and they really pushed education. And so he actually graduated high school, I think when he was 15, and went to UCLA when he was 16 for full scholarship. I think he graduated dental school when he was 19, maybe. But you'll like this story. So when he was in high school, there was still a lot of anti-Semitism. When I say still, it's back. But
right.
At the time, it was very prominent. And they lived in a poor area. And, you know, he was one of the only Jewish kids at the school. He went to Hamilton at the time, which was a much more rough school than it is now. And he comes home every day beat up. And he was a pretty big guy. And my grandmother goes into the principal, and she had this very heavy Polish accent. And she's like, my son's getting beat up every day. And you know, the principal says, well, there's so many kids, nothing I could do about it. So she goes home and tells my dad, you have to fight. Huh. And 2 weeks later, she gets a call from the principal. Comes in and he says, your son has beat up 14 kids in the last 10 days. She says, so many kids, nothing I could do about it. Walks out. So he grew up, and what I guess he instilled in me too is, you know, not believe, fight for what you believe in,
right.
Stick firm to your values. You know, fight when you need to fight, don't fight when you don't need to fight. But he was driven to the highest degree. He graduated dental school early, became the top reconstructive dental surgeon. He was also had the world record for bench press. He was 265 pounds. He was like,
that's, you know, crazy.
Worked out at, you know, Muscle Beach and stuff. And then was an extreme skier. Took a jump and his ski binding fell off in there. Broke his neck. Broke his leg. Triple compound fracture. And had to stop practicing dentistry. Went back and got his MBA at UCLA. Graduated number one in his class and went into mergers and acquisitions.
He had a couple of inventions, right?
That was more recent. So he actually, after that, he was doing mergers and acquisitions and realized that he was never going to be happy unless he could go back to practicing medicine. And so he was 40-something years old, and he went and took the MCATs, got the highest score on the MCATs, and both USC and UCLA said, no one at your age has made it through like first year med school. So you got to go somewhere, one of these top schools. You get through 1 year, we'll take you. So he went to the University of Chicago, Illinois, which is still a really good school. Mm-hmm. Came home to California every weekend, worked full time, number one in his class, was also number one in fitness in his class. And he was 40, everybody else was 20. And then transferred to USC, graduated number one in his class there, became an eye surgeon. Then started teaching eye surgery at UCLA. And then got into one of the first people who was built out LASIK centers. Right. And then effectively co-founded this company that was called Calhoun at the time. And it's now a big public company. And then got into more research and started a company that was called ZetaRx, renamed Juno. And that went public in 2014. It's the largest biotech of 2014, and then in 2018, it sold for like $11 billion. So
growing up, what was it like to see a father with extreme work ethic, extremely fit, driven? What was that? What was that relationship like for you?
Yeah. It was tough. So I was a little scared of my dad growing up. You know, he was a great dad. I mean, he was very present. They made sure I had everything I needed. Not everything I wanted, but everything I needed. Because we were, as much as he was extremely educated and successful in his own right, like, we weren't wealthy. We were middle class. And, you know, I went to Brentwood. I was one of the, you know, we lived in a, 2,000 square foot rental house in Brentwood. You know, it wasn't like we grew up wealthy. And I always had tutors and tennis lessons, and they made sure I had everything I needed.
Right.
But you know, my first car was a minivan and then a Saturn, right? All my friends were driving Porsches and, you know, BMWs.
Did that motive, not to cut you off, but that had to have been some motivation for you.
Oh, huge.
And I mean, we'll come back to that.
All around.
That had to have been motivation, because if you're seeing people drive Porsches and Mercedes to school and you're driving a minivan, but your dad has got work ethic and he got this commitment to excellence and is driven, and you got a good household, that inside of you, it gotta it got to create this individual that has some fire, some
it
drive.
Definitely put fire. And my dad put fire because my parents are still my best friends today, and they're happier married today at 74 than, I mean, people say like it doesn't exist. They're like a love story. But, and my mom, you know, she worked full time and raised us. My dad was the disciplinarian in like the tough situations. But what was very interesting is he instilled a work ethic that was like, I could always do what I wanted to do. And if I didn't do something well, or I got a bad grade, or I wasn't the best on the tennis team or track, or didn't succeed at something, it was never like, I never got, oh, well, you tried your hardest, ever. It was always like, I mean, you could have done it if you wanted to, period. Never like, it was like, the only reason you didn't get number one, the only reason you weren't the best is just because you decided not to be. So that's what I grew up with. And that's like, it took me a long time to get through that.
Do you think that's your first failure? That right there? Because that's pretty deep. I don't want people to overlook that. That was really deep because your father made it you versus you.
So my first failure came from that, I think. I've never quite figured it out. But when I was 14, I got diagnosed with anxiety disease.
Okay.
And I remember I just all of a sudden woke up one day and it was like, everybody's going to die. My parents are going to die. My family's going to die. I'm going to die. Like, what's the point of life? Like, what am I doing? And I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to go to school.
How old were you?
14.
14. Okay.
And at the time, there was the word anxiety was not a word. So I didn't even know what to call it. I was just like, I had this feeling I used to call it. And I, for like months, just didn't want to do anything. My parents didn't know what to do with me.
What was the plan? I mean, how did you attack it?
I mean, they took me to like 10 shrinks, you know, not 10, but, they, you know, one shrink after another to try and find someone to help me. And I still remember, like, there's this one thing etched in my brain, which I've never shared. And I remember my grandmother. So I'll cut back because I'm going to talk about my mom. My mom grew up really well. So my mom grew up in Beverly Hills. Her dad was a pharmacist, which he owned the pharmacy that was on the corner of Santa Monica and
yes.
Beverly Glen. So my grandfather, that was his pharmacy. He owned that property. And, you know, he raised my mom, as we kind of say, to be a princess. So they met at UCLA. Actually, the joke is when they met my dad, my grandmother and grandfather took my mom aside. They're like, listen, you're going to get over it. It's only chemistry. Like, they did not want her with my dad.
Oh, wow.
And the funniest is that my dad and her parents turned out to be, they were as close as he was with his parents. But my mom was a little more, I'd say, you know, trying to understand and more emotional about it. My dad was just, you know, he grew up tough. Like, his parents didn't have a childhood.
Right.
So he didn't really have a childhood, right? So to him, I'm dealing with this, like, crazy emotion. I'm crying all the time. I'm like, I don't want to do anything. And his natural reaction was like, just get your shit together, right? Just like, do it. And I'm like, but I can't. It's this feeling, right? And I think my mom tried really hard at first, and there wasn't no information about anxiety.
Right.
And eventually, I mean, I'd say I failed for a good year of like, I failed in life. I mean, I was just.
Did your grades drop? Did like, you? So you weren't around friends, you wasn't motivated?
Everything.
You just.
I basically didn't
no tennis.
School. Nothing. I was like.
Was that middle school or freshman year?
I was in, I think, eighth grade. Not think I know I was in eighth grade. I like missed half of eighth grade. And then finally, my dad moved my mom out and moved my brother out into their friend's house. And he created a program. He's like, you're going to live by this program. And it was like, today you're going to do this for an hour. Tomorrow you're going to go to school for 2 hours. The next day you're going to go for three. And it ended after a whole year of like adding something on with me. He had a special favor to pull, going to Oxford University for the summer for 8 weeks in London at 14 years old and taking college classes. And I got through it. It was tough. And
So your dad created a program. He created a system for you, but he took away your parents. He took away your mother, took away your brother.
Yeah. Well, it was because he knew that I was going to lose it. And he didn't want me to go to my mom and be like, don't make me do this. He knew he had to be like, you know, Mr. Disciplinarian, and that's what it was. It was every day adding another thing that was hard for me.
You know, when in sports, and even in life, people never find out who they are until you remove everything.
It's true.
And you put their back against the wall. And they always say, like, if you put an animal or if you put someone in a cage and you put their back, you'll really figure out
who that person is.
Who that person is. And that's kind of genius.
It was, you know, it was interesting because you look today at, you know, what the world knows about anxiety, and it could have gone either direction.
Right.
It could have broken me but you know, I mean, to his credit, because he was a very tough guy.
Right.
Like, and he was big and he was scary. I mean, I remember fights where, like, he'd be yelling at me for, you know, this, like, it was hard. It was frustrating for them, I'm sure, to see that me upset, crying, no idea why. I remember one time I took those pull-up bars that have reverse tension?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So I used it to lock my door against a bed. And my dad was also a triple black belt at karate, so he just kicked my door down.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I remember there were a few instances like that where there was a fear, but also I had this respect because he was so good at everything, right? And so, you know, he wasn't just a scary guy. He never hit me. He never was, like, you know, physical, but he was very present.
Did you ever have a fight?
You mean, did I ever
a fist fight
with my dad?
No.
Oh yeah.
At school.
Oh yeah. I remember the first fight I remember. Actually, no. My dad always reminds me of this fight. So my dad put me in karate starting when I was six, and he always tells this story. My brother was too. How we were at Paul Revere and high school, and at a soccer game, and they look over, and there's these older kids, I guess, who were picking on us. And my dad sees it happening, like, across the field. And he comes walking over. And by the time we get over there, my brother and I had these kids in chokeholds. And they're like, get these kids off. These are fucking crazy. But the real first fight I had, I remember my dad got me a red Saturn. I was very proud of my red Saturn, even though other people made fun of me for it. And it was peppy, you know, a little five speed.
I remember.
Pull up next to this M3 and I'm revving in Beverly Hills, and I had a bunch of friends in the car because I was one of the earlier guys to drive in my class. And I go ahead of them, and I kind of remember we're pulling into a deli, and they're like, oh, the deli's there. And I kind of cut them off, not meaning to. I go park, friends go running inside, and I get out. Oh, and I remember the back of the BMW had UCLA bodybuilding on the back sticker. And these three guys walk up to me and they're like, hey, you the guy in the red car. And the thing is, nobody had seen a Saturn back then. So a lot of people were asking me what it was. And I'm like, yeah. Bam. I mean, front, back, left, right. I mean, and I was the guy from the parking lot came running out. He's like, you okay? He's like, that was so loud. It was reverberating in the parking lot. Wow. And so I remember I went home and I told my dad, I'm like, yeah, I got beat up. And he's like, what happened to karate? I was like, I don't know. Just kind of. So he made sure I never got beat up again. He was like, we're going to go. You know, we're going to spar and get back at that. So, yeah, then I never lost a fight after that.
That sounds like a scene out of Back to Future or something like that.
It was bad. I was like, I just remember hitting it on the ground. My head's ringing and I'm like, what hit me? You know, and I'm just like, it was the guys I cut off, obviously.
So at Brentwood, you played tennis.
Yeah.
What was your success rate there? Like, were you a winner? Were you a loser?
I was pretty good. So I was number one doubles. Varsity, and then number like three singles. So I was pretty good. I wasn't the best, but also I think our number one guy went Olympic, so it was a pretty good. And Brentwood was a competitive team, and I was pretty good at track and field. And I also was the youngest kid to win speech and debate CIF, I was in ninth grade when I won, which was crazy.
That's why you're so good at fighting and arguments and.
Probably.
Yeah,
I learned
early.
Good
at debate.
Yeah. I had to. In my family, you had to debate everything. Mm. So it was, I mean, yeah. So growing up, you know, it's funny because a lot of people here, you went to Brentwood, you know, my dad was a doctor. You must have grown up wealthy. Like, no. I mean, like I said, compared to 99.999% of the world, I grew up amazing, right? But compared to the people around me, like we went on, you know, a vacation every year or whatever, but we didn't go like,
right.
There was no, it wasn't super fancy, right? You know, we worked hard for everything. Like, I think I was telling you earlier, I remember I had my mom's credit card for emergencies. And I remember I went to Fred Siegel. Diesel jeans had just come out. And I'm like, I just want a pair of diesel jeans, man. They were these green, I still remember these green diesel jeans. They were $110. I charged on my mom's card. I remember it came in, and I remember my dad yelled at me for probably 3 days. You fucking stole from me? Like, you bought a pair of $110 jeans? Like I used to buy my jeans at Sears for $9. What the fuck is $110 jeans? And I still remember, like, that's blazed in my head. So it was, we were taught, you know, you work for what you have, you work hard. And I still remember I was talking about my Saturn versus other people. Oh, he has a Porsche. And it's like, I don't care if I had $2 billion, I wouldn't buy you a Porsche. You're a 16-year-old kid. And, you know, thinking back, I'm like, he's right. But back then I was thinking, why can't I just have a Porsche?
But he was teaching you values, teaching you to have some integrity.
Yeah.
When did you get your first job?
My parents made me work every summer. So starting when I was actually really young, I think when I was 12, my dad had me intern at his friend's real estate office. And then when I was 14, I actually got my first real job. Every summer I had a job working at Humphrey Yogurt, scooping ice cream. And then I worked at Kelly's Coffee. These were like, and then I was like, okay, working for someone's just not for me. I think I got fired from every job I had, literally. Like, and it, for crazy reasons, like, you know, at Humphrey Yogurt, that movie, remember that movie Cocktail with Tom Cruise? Yes. So me and this other guy figured out we could flip the ice cream and flip the toppings, and we were getting tips, like huge tips. We were put on these shows people would come in for, till I flipped the ice cream and it landed in some girl's purse, and it turned out it was the owner's best friend. So I got fired from that job. And then I had Kelly's, and Kelly's, I remember, I had the opening shift. Summer was like 5:30 a.m. And I remember I woke up at like 5:20 and I was like, nah, fuck this. I called. I was like, I'm sick. Lost that job. So then that's when I went into business for my own. So I actually started with baseball cards. I'd always collected baseball cards. So I started with my dad, who also collected something called All-Star Baseball Cards.
Mm-hmm. I remember.
And we would trade with, remember Beverly Hills Card Shop?
Yeah.
So I would trade cards. And then I got the idea of vending machines.
So you own a vending machine?
I didn't at the time. I went and convinced my dad that it was a great idea to help me buy some vending machines. And my mom was one of the first female brokers in Los Angeles, real estate brokers. And so she worked at John Douglas, which is used to be the biggest real estate company. So I went around and put these vending machines in her offices at the, you know, in the real estate offices. And that was like my first business, if you will. And then from there I went into, like, at the time you had to get a license for pepper spray.
Right.
So then I was like, oh, all these agents need protection. So I went and got the license from the DOJ to license pepper spray. And then I would give classes to all the real estate agents for pepper spray.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So that's, I knew very early on, like, working for someone was like very not in the cards for me.
But at the same time, your dad's pushing education. So he's pushing traditional. Right. And you're thinking non-traditional. So that causes you to pivot. So you have to go against the grain. You have to be strong. So whether you failed or not, you still got to keep going.